Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording about beekeeping. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Well, honeybees are disappearing globally at an alarming rate. It's due to pesticides, parasites, disease, and habitat loss. Now, the EU has restricted the use of so-called neonicotinoid insecticides. Now, these have been partly blamed for the dramatic decline in bee populations. However, many farmers say that the insecticides are vital to prevent crops from being destroyed by pests. Well, Rosie Waite spoke to Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association. And he says more needs to be done to ban dangerous pesticides.
Beekeepers were the first to find out that there was something wrong with the approval of these pesticides. After a long process, we have a partial ban. This ban should be expanded. We need to look at how was it possible for these products to get approved in the first place. The scientists at the EFSA, European Food Safety Authority, have gone through the process of re-evaluating these testing methods. They've made a proposal how to improve them, and now it's up to the politicians to actually enact this. Industry wants to water down this process because they're afraid that if these products are being tested properly, they might not enter the market at all.
And why should we be concerned and worried about the future of the bees? Would we actually starve if there were no bees?
There is a fair number of crops that simply depend on pollination by honeybees or their wild relatives. And those are crops that make our food healthy and diverse. Honeybees are a success story over millions of years through all kinds of climate change and whatnot. They've been a very resilient species. So if we manage to mess up our ecosystems to the points that even the honeybees are in trouble, that is a warning signal that we should take seriously.
And it seems like it's relatively easy to get a beehive and keep bees in your garden. Do you think that people need to be properly trained and to be more knowledgeable?
There are new beekeepers joining the beekeeping community that don't want to keep many hives, that have the idea that maybe I don't even need the honey. I just want to provide space for bees so that they're out there in the garden pollinating. And this is a way of beekeeping that is simply not possible because you need to be trained enough to really take care of the bees. So if you are somebody that wants to do something positive for the bees, there is another possibility where you create habitat, you create nesting places, and you'll be surprised how many bees will actually just show up and be out there pollinating your garden.
That's Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association. Thank you. Well, honeybees are disappearing globally at an alarming rate. It's due to pesticides, parasites, disease and habitat loss. Now, the EU has restricted the use of so-called neonicotinoid insecticides. Now, these have been partly blamed for the dramatic decline in bee populations. However, many farmers say that the insecticides are vital to prevent crops from being destroyed by pests. Well, Rosie Waite spoke to Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association. And he says more needs to be done to ban dangerous pesticides.
Beekeepers were the first to find out that there was something wrong with the approval of these pesticides. After a long process, we have a partial ban. This ban should be expanded. We need to look at how was it possible for these products to get approved in the first place. The scientists at the EFSA, European Food Safety Authority, have gone through the process of re-evaluating these testing methods. They've made a proposal how to improve them, and now it's up to the politicians to actually enact this. Industry wants to water down this process because they're afraid that if these products are being tested properly, they might not enter the market at all.
And why should we be concerned and worried about the future of the bees? Would we actually starve if there were no bees?
There is a fair number of crops that simply depend on pollination by honeybees or their wild relatives. And those are crops that make our food healthy and diverse. Honeybees are a success story over millions of years through all kinds of climate change and whatnot. They've been a very resilient species. So if we manage to mess up our ecosystems to the points that even the honeybees are in trouble, that is a warning signal that we should take seriously.
And it seems like it's relatively easy to get a beehive and keep bees in your garden. Do you think that people need to be properly trained and to be more knowledgeable?
There are new beekeepers joining the beekeeping community that don't want to keep many hives, that have the idea that maybe I don't even need the honey. I just want to provide space for bees so that they're out there in the garden pollinating. And this is a way of beekeeping that is simply not possible because you need to be trained enough to really take care of the bees. So if you are somebody that wants to do something positive for the bees, there is another possibility where you create habitat, you create nesting places, and you'll be surprised how many bees will actually just show up and be out there pollinating your garden.
That's Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a recording about people living in a dry region. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 7 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Let's go now to a tiny community tucked in the heart of California's Central Valley. It's a place where people have been living with very little water for a very long time and still face increasing water bills. As NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, some low-income residents there worry that if they can't pay their water bills, the county could shut off their taps.
On a dusty single-lane road about an hour west of Fresno, there's a small rustic mom-and-pop store selling not much more than beer, soda, and chips. We're in a remote rural community called Cantua Creek, surrounded by orchards and fallow fields. The owner, Leticia Fernandez, is a small, vivacious woman who says her store has seen better times.
I mean, we used to have produce and milk. Deliveries were here every week. Now, twice a month.
Fernandez blames a drought. Customers disappeared as local ranchers didn't bother to plant row crops for lack of water. No farm workers, no customers, says Fernandez.
So that means that the people that live here now, we have to look for jobs elsewhere.
Fernandez says the drought made matters worse by making the cost of water unaffordable. And here's where the story gets complicated. Cantua Creek is a small community of about 400 residents. They are mostly older, retired, or disabled farm workers on fixed incomes. Their water supply is passed through the local water district to Fresno County. Recently, that district tripled the price of water. County officials tried to raise water fees in Cantua Creek by about $30 per month to cover the increase. But the community said no. Even if you have to shut the water off by May, we can't afford it.
Why? Because the water that we're receiving there is not water that is treated enough for us to drink it. So the only way we use that water is either to wash dishes, clothes, or take a shower.
They already shell out an additional $6 per 5-gallon jug of drinking water. So the notion of paying more for water they can't even drink is especially upsetting. That leaves Fresno County officials scrambling for a solution that could include consolidating future water supplies for several small communities to bring down the price. Officials say the county is in no position to pay for Cantua Creek's water. The residents have to pay for themselves. Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea says the county has no legal obligation to help the residents of Cantua Creek, but he says,
the question is for us politically is, are we really going to let these folks just basically wither on the vine?
Last week, word spread that the state of California would step in with short-term drought emergency funds, about $120,000, to help Cantua Creek pay its water bill. James Mahan is an assistant deputy director for financial assistance at the State Water Resources Control Board. He says the state aid comes with strings.
They've got to reduce the amount of water that they're using because it is very expensive.
Back in Cantua Creek, Leticia Fernandez says she and her neighbors are already conserving. They've installed low-flow shower heads, limited flushing, no water for gardens or washing cars. Then she points to her brown lawn.
Don't you think that's conserving already? We're not drinking it. So what else do they want us to do with this water?
As the drought's grip tightens, that question is being posed in more communities facing a dwindling supply of water.
Let's go now to a tiny community tucked in the heart of California's Central Valley. It's a place where people have been living with very little water for a very long time and still face increasing water bills. As NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, some low-income residents there worry that if they can't pay their water bills, the county could shut off their taps.
On a dusty single-lane road about an hour west of Fresno, there's a small rustic mom-and-pop store selling not much more than beer, soda, and chips. We're in a remote rural community called Cantua Creek, surrounded by orchards and fallow fields. The owner, Leticia Fernandez, is a small, vivacious woman who says her store has seen better times.
I mean, we used to have produce and milk. Deliveries were here every week. Now, twice a month.
Fernandez blames a drought. Customers disappeared as local ranchers didn't bother to plant row crops for lack of water. No farm workers, no customers, says Fernandez.
So that means that the people that live here now, we have to look for jobs elsewhere.
Fernandez says the drought made matters worse by making the cost of water unaffordable, and here's where the story gets complicated. Cantua Creek is a small community of about 400 residents. They are mostly older, retired, or disabled farm workers on fixed incomes. Their water supply is passed through the local water district to Fresno County. Recently, that district tripled the price of water. County officials tried to raise water fees in Cantua Creek by about $30 per month to cover the increase. But the community said no. Even if you have to shut the water off by May, we can't afford it.
Why? Because the water that we're receiving there is not water that is treated enough for us to drink it. So the only way we use that water is either to wash dishes, clothes, or take a shower.
They already shell out an additional $6 per 5-gallon jug of drinking water. So the notion of paying more for water they can't even drink is especially upsetting. That leaves Fresno County officials scrambling for a solution that could include consolidating future water supplies for several small communities to bring down the price. Officials say the county is in no position to pay for Cantua Creek's water. The residents have to pay for themselves. Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea says the county has no legal obligation to help the residents of Cantua Creek, but he says,
the question is for us politically is, are we really going to let these folks just basically wither on the vine?
Last week, word spread that the state of California would step in with short-term drought emergency funds, about $120,000, to help Cantua Creek pay its water bill. James Mahan is an assistant deputy director for financial assistance at the State Water Resources Control Board. He says the state aid comes with strings.
They've got to reduce the amount of water that they're using because it is very expensive.
Back in Cantua Creek, Leticia Fernandez says she and her neighbors are already conserving. They've installed low-flow shower heads, limited flushing, no water for gardens or washing cars. Then she points to her brown lawn.
Don't you think that's conserving already? We're not drinking it. So what else do they want us to do with this water?
As the drought's grip tightens, that question is being posed in more communities facing a dwindling supply of water.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about stress. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 10, with the sentence endings, A to M. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I seem to be reading that people are more stressed than ever before. I hear it all the time. But is that really true, or is that just something we like to say?
No, I think it really is true. I mean, if you just take a look at the workplace, Muscular skeletal diseases was the main cause of sickness absence in the UK for decades. Now it is the common mental disorders of depression, anxiety, and stress. They are now the leading cause of sickness absence, not just in the UK workforce, by the way, but throughout the developed world. You'll see that in the EU, in EU countries, in North America. It is now the leading cause.
Okay, I understand that in the workplace, as jobs have changed, so have the reasons for sickness, from physical problems to mental ones. But are there actually any stats to back this up?
Well, this is a slightly tricky one. As Kairi said, people have only been studying stress since the 50s, so it's still a relatively new field scientifically, and there haven't been many studies looking at a change in population health. But what there has been has brought in, well, I think some quite alarming statistics. When asking, are we getting more stressed? Universities have reported a 10% increase in uptake of their counselling services year on year, with mental health problems on campus raising from 8,000 to 18,000 cases in just 4 years.
Wow, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, I was looking for studies and I came across this one and was really quite surprised. And then in terms of really big numbers, in 2014, the charity Mind, the mental health charity, found that 56% of the workers they polled reported workplace stress, which is really a crazy amount.
Sorry, I'm a bit speechless. 56% is a staggering amount. But I wonder, is there a difference between stress and just, you know, having a lot on your plate?
Yeah. Absolutely. And so when does stress become a problem? And actually, this is something I ask Kairi, the difference between pressure and stress.
People will say, I'm stressed. Basically, when they say that, just generally, they mean they're under pressure. By the way, pressure is stimulating and motivating. But when pressure exceeds your ability to cope, then you're in the stress arena. And when that happens, you'll get ill health consequences.
And if we are more stressed, you mentioned that the types of jobs we're doing have changed, but also a lot of other things have changed about the world that we live in now. So what's causing this increased stress?
Oh, there's a variety of things. First of all, technological advance is much faster than ever before. People have been more mobile. Think about it. 30 or 40 years ago, people worked within a radius of 30 miles of where they lived. They had the community around them. They had their extended family. We don't have the extended family anymore. We don't have the natural counselors in our environment, the aunties, the grandmas, the neighbors who knew four generations of your family, who were people you could go talk to because we weren't mobile. But now people are looking for jobs. They're moving away from their extended family. And basically, we're now into just the mother, the father, the kids. So we don't have now the kind of support systems that we had then. And really, the insecurity in society generally now. Jobs are no longer for life, and we're working longer hours. If you take the UK, we have the longest working hours in the developed world behind the United States.
You talked about connectivity, but connectivity through technology, we are constantly switched on and constantly available. We talk about relationships, but it's a very different type of relationship, that, isn't it?
Yeah, what's also happening, I think, is not only the speed of technology and the constant change that we're undergoing as a major kind of outside source of stress on people, but think about information and communication technologies. Just think about email. Email is overloading people. Through mobile technology, it's making people on 724. And in fact, it's interesting that many employers now are closing down their servers at the weekend because people are accessing it too often, some at night. The technology has gone so fast that we're not in control of it. It's in control of us.
I seem to be reading that people are more stressed than ever before. I hear it all the time. But is that really true, or is that just something we like to say?
No, I think it really is true. I mean, if you just take a look at the workplace, muscular skeletal diseases was the main cause of sickness absence in the UK for decades. Now it is the common mental disorders of depression, anxiety, and stress. They are now the leading cause of sickness absence, not just in the UK workforce, by the way, but throughout the developed world. You'll see that in the EU, in EU countries, in North America. It is now the leading cause.
Okay, I understand that in the workplace, as jobs have changed, so have the reasons for sickness, from physical problems to mental ones. But are there actually any stats to back this up?
Well, this is a slightly tricky one. As Kerry said, people have only been studying stress since the 50s, so it's still a relatively new field scientifically, and there haven't been many studies looking at a change in population health. But what there has been has brought in, well, I think some quite alarming statistics. When asking, are we getting more stressed? Universities have reported a 10% increase in uptake of their counselling services year on year, with mental health problems on campus raising from 8,000 to 18,000 cases in just 4 years.
Wow, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, I was looking for studies and I came across this one and was really quite surprised. And then in terms of really big numbers, in 2014, the charity Mind, the mental health charity, found that 56% of the workers they polled reported workplace stress, which is really a crazy amount.
Sorry, I'm a bit speechless. 56% is a staggering amount. But I wonder, is there a difference between stress and just, you know, having a lot on your plate?
Yeah. Absolutely. And so when does stress become a problem? And actually, this is something I asked Kerry, the difference between pressure and stress.
People will say, I'm stressed. Basically, when they say that, just generally, they mean they're under pressure. By the way, pressure is stimulating and motivating. But when pressure exceeds your ability to cope, then you're in the stress arena. And when that happens, you'll get ill health consequences.
And if we are more stressed, you mentioned that the types of jobs we're doing have changed, but also a lot of other things have changed about the world that we live in now. So what's causing this increased stress?
Oh, there's a variety of things. First of all, technological advance is much faster than ever before. People have been more mobile. Think about it. 30 or 40 years ago, people worked within a radius of 30 miles of where they lived. They had the community around them. They had their extended family. We don't have the extended family anymore. We don't have the natural counselors in our environment, the aunties, the grandmas, the neighbors who knew four generations of your family, who were people you could go talk to because we weren't mobile. But now people are looking for jobs. They're moving away from their extended family. And basically, we're now into just the mother, the father, the kids. So we don't have now the kind of support systems that we had then. And really, the insecurity in society generally now. Jobs are no longer for life, and we're working longer hours. If you take the UK, we have the longest working hours in the developed world behind the United States.
You talked about connectivity, but connectivity through technology, we are constantly switched on and constantly available. We talk about relationships, but it's a very different type of relationship, that, isn't it?
Yeah, what's also happening, I think, is not only the speed of technology and the constant change that we're undergoing as a major kind of outside source of stress on people, but think about information and communication technologies. Just think about email. Email is overloading people. Through mobile technology, it's making people on 724. And in fact, it's interesting that many employers now are closing down their servers at the weekend because people are accessing it too often, some at night. The technology has gone so fast that we're not in control of it. It's in control of us.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a recording about how a district in San Francisco was affected by an earthquake and fire. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
So many of the city's political and business leaders were actually excited about this social equalizing disaster because it eliminated Chinatown and they thought, we'll never rebuild it.
Many whites had seen the neighborhood as a Gomorrah of opium dens, prostitution, and disease. But Chinatown also occupied prime downtown real estate, that the city's power brokers had long been eyeing. In 1904, 2 years before the fire, then-Mayor James Phelan had asked architect Daniel Burnham to draft some sketches of a new downtown. And in those sketches, there simply is no Chinatown.
And so the minute the city goes up in flames, I'm not kidding, I don't think the city's finished burning, and James Phelan is telegraphing Daniel Burnham, send more reports immediately, get them to the hands of the city leaders and business leaders. Here's the perfect city.
In the days after the fire, the current mayor, Eugene Schmitz, worked fast to make that perfect city a reality. He appointed James Phelan and other powerful leaders to a committee entirely dedicated to relocating Chinatown. The leading proposal punted Chinese residents to the outskirts of town, among the city's slaughterhouses. Davies says the beleaguered Chinese community soon caught wind of the plan.
And they fought back, and I think they fought back very intelligently.
The Chinese launched their self-defense on multiple fronts. First, they simply started rebuilding in Chinatown before others got there. One Chinese-language newspaper, the Cheng Sai Yat Po, made sure Chinese refugees knew their land rights.
According to U.S. laws, if the land belongs to the building owner, the landlord has the right to build on his land. Local officials have no right to stop him.
Even China's Empress Dowager Cixi got involved, sending her consul general from Washington to meet with San Francisco officials. But the most significant move was economic. For decades, San Francisco had been a key hub for lucrative trade with China. So a group of the city's top Chinese merchants wrote to Mayor Schmitz in a language city officials easily understood.
And so the negotiation was, okay, you don't want us to come back? We can go to Tacoma. We can go to Portland. So there's a panic of a loss of revenue for the city.
By May 10, less than a month after the fire, the mayor dissolved his committee to relocate Chinatown. Filmmaker Felicia Lowe says it was a political victory on an unprecedented scale.
They outsmarted and they outplayed the city fathers to fight fire with fire.
But the Chinese community took their victory one step further. San Francisco was a blank slate after the fire. So instead of letting the city draw up new architecture, an American-born Chinese merchant named Luk Tin Eli had a plan.
The word was, build me a pagoda.
Before the fire, Chinatown's architecture had blended in with the rest of San Francisco's Italianate buildings. But Luk Tin Eli's blueprint would make the rebuilt Chinatown into what he described as a new Oriental city.
He was able to pull together the resources and a committee of like-minded Chinese merchants to hire white architects to create a Chinatown that looked the way white people imagined Chinatown to look. Even though he knew in his own mind that the buildings in China didn't look like this.
The result was a Chinatown that Lowe calls a Disneyland vision of China. Pagoda-topped buildings, bright reds and golds, and dragon symbols everywhere. It used Western stereotypes to rake in tourist dollars and to give the district a new reputation for cleanliness and safety. Consider it a sort of architectural revenge. Today, Chinatown remains one of San Francisco's most visited neighborhoods.
So many of the city's political and business leaders were actually excited about this social equalizing disaster because it eliminated Chinatown and they thought, we'll never rebuild it.
Many whites had seen the neighborhood as a Gomorrah of opium dens, prostitution, and disease. But Chinatown also occupied prime downtown real estate, real estate that the city's power brokers had long been eyeing. In 1904, 2 years before the fire, then-Mayor James Phelan had asked architect Daniel Burnham to draft some sketches of a new downtown. And in those sketches, there simply is no Chinatown.
And so the minute the city goes up in flames, I'm not kidding, I don't think the city's finished burning, and James Phelan is telegraphing Daniel Burnham, send more reports immediately, get them to the hands of the city leaders and business leaders. Here's the perfect city.
In the days after the fire, the current mayor, Eugene Schmitz, worked fast to make that perfect city a reality. He appointed James Phelan and other powerful leaders to a committee entirely dedicated to relocating Chinatown. The leading proposal punted Chinese residents to the outskirts of town, among the city's slaughterhouses. Davies says the beleaguered Chinese community soon caught wind of the plan.
And they fought back, and I think they fought back very intelligently.
The Chinese launched their self-defense on multiple fronts. First, they simply started rebuilding in Chinatown before others got there. One Chinese language newspaper, the Cheng Sai Yat Po, made sure Chinese refugees knew their land rights.
According to U.S. laws, if the land belongs to the building owner, the landlord has the right to build on his land. Local officials have no right to stop him.
Even China's Empress Dowager Cixi got involved, sending her consul general from Washington to meet with San Francisco officials. But the most significant move was economic. For decades, San Francisco had been a key hub for lucrative trade with China. So a group of the city's top Chinese merchants wrote to Mayor Schmitz in a language city officials easily understood.
And so the negotiation was, okay, you don't want us to come back? We can go to Tacoma. We can go to Portland. So there's a panic of a loss of revenue for the city.
By May 10, less than a month after the fire, the mayor dissolved his committee to relocate Chinatown. Filmmaker Felicia Lowe says it was a political victory on an unprecedented scale.
They outsmarted and they outplayed the city fathers to fight fire with fire.
But the Chinese community took their victory one step further. San Francisco was a blank slate after the fire. So instead of letting the city draw up new architecture, an American-born Chinese merchant named Luk Tin Eli had a plan.
The word was, build me a pagoda.
Before the fire, Chinatown's architecture had blended in with the rest of San Francisco's Italianate buildings. But Luk Tin Eli's blueprint would make the rebuilt Chinatown into what he described as a new Oriental city.
He was able to pull together the resources and a committee of like-minded Chinese merchants to hire white architects to create a Chinatown that looked the way white people imagined Chinatown to look. Even though he knew in his own mind that the buildings in China didn't look like this.
The result was a Chinatown that Lowe calls a Disneyland vision of China. Pagoda-topped buildings, bright reds and golds, and dragon symbols everywhere. It used Western stereotypes to rake in tourist dollars and to give the district a new reputation for cleanliness and safety. Consider it a sort of architectural revenge. Today, Chinatown remains one of San Francisco's most visited neighborhoods.
This is the end of the listening test.